Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talked to Brendan Johnson, the Executive Director of the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition. The GNSC made the news last week for its impressive charm offensive at the public delegation night for the 2018 tax-supported operating budget, a pitch for an extra $100,000 in additional funding on top of what it already receives, because according to Johnson and his team, the coalition has grown at a rate far faster than expected. Why and how they've gotten so big, and too big to fail, to borrow a phrase, is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, saying the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition is too big to fail may sound insulting when thinking of the origin of that phrase, the predatory banks in the United States that caused near global economic calamity in 2008, but seriously, it's a compliment and a tribute to the work they do that the GNSC has made themselves so indispensable to the 13 neighborhood groups that they work with and the countless people active within them. Believe it or not, the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition has been around for a while, dating back to the late 80s when funding from the City of Guelph and Family and Children's Services was split between two groups. Nearly 30 years later, though, the GNSC is not just a funnel for funds, but an incubator for innovative ideas and community participation across a myriad of issues that make up the individual needs of its baker's dozen of neighborhood groups. Along with that, they act as a mediator between grassroots citizen action and the bureaucracy at City Hall, the police service, and provincial and federal agencies. The GNSC now means 262 programs with 52,063 participants across the city, facilitated by two full-time staff members and just over 1,500 volunteers, contributing over 35,000 hours for assistance. It turns out, though, that success has a cost, and the price tag for the GNSC to keep doing what they're doing, it seems, is $100,000 more, which will pay for staff supports, supervision, as well as program oversight and risk management. The risk is that the coalition might no longer be able to offer all that it presently does, but isn't a group that can get 11 people to speak for it in front of city council worth preserving? That will ultimately be decided by City Council, but I wanted to go beyond the cold hard numbers and get to the behind-the-scenes view of what the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition does. Having said that, I'm not sure that's what we got in this week's podcast. What follows, I think, is a very much more philosophical discussion about what the coalition does and what it means to people in a time when they're thirsty for leadership and direction, but are uncertain about how they can take action. For many people, those big wood doors on the council chambers are intimidating, or calling up a government agency and trying to overcome the technobabble of governance is intimidating. So how do we tear down those walls and engage people in a way they understand to get the results they need? There may be an answer inside this episode of the Guelph Politicast. So I caught up with Brendan Johnson last week at 10C. So Brendan Johnson, thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you. Yeah, this is exciting. We've been meaning to for a while, so this is cool.
We have been meaning to for a while. But having said that, it seemed like a good time that it worked out in the end. The big turnout and show of support at the public delegation night at the city council for the budget. So that seems like a good place to start. It seems like, from the sound of it, and maybe without getting into too much of the numbers and the budget situation, sure. But it seems like where you are in the middle of your own current grant program,
yeah,
you have exceeded where you thought you would be just, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's our claim anyway.
But having said that, you know, how did you get here so fast that the group managed to grow beyond any, I guess, even, you know, I know in grant writing you tend to try and think moderately, but, you know, even by that standard, you got here pretty quick in terms of the limits of your current growth.
Yeah, and I guess what I what happened was that kind of building of that it's called a CBA, Community Benefit Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the legwork was done prior to me coming into the job.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't even me who created the first framework. So there was City and Family Children's Services were kind of lead agents in how this work could move back to the community and not be kind of in a bureaucracy anymore. How could it...
Mm-hmm.
I guess everyone felt like there's kind of limitations to creativity and flexibility and kind of adaptiveness
right.
when it's in a larger org that has, you know, different constrictures around it. So I think part of it was, how can we just make that happen? And I don't know, I'm sure lots of people had lots of aspirational thoughts, but maybe not. Like, what could it be if all these things do happen? It was, we want and need these things to happen. So I think that was a factor of, you know, not maybe foreseeing how the organization could be connected in a more collaborative way. I think that was always in there, but not in the agreement or the thoughts of kind of results based. Like, what happens when they start working with other core community organizations, and how can resources be shared, and how could we kind of build that bigger network of like-minded people doing stuff in the city? So I think that's a lot of where it's expanded. And in all this, whatever I say, the city's been tremendous supporters, but I think sometimes what happens is, I think people are leery of bureaucracy for good and bad reasons, and that I think maybe some of the orgs or some of the neighborhood groups that have joined us maybe just didn't imagine themselves sitting within a city structure or a bureaucratic structure. So I think once it was freed from that kind of confines, people were intrigued and then saw what was happening in other neighbor groups in the coalition, then maybe it was easier for that conversation to happen.
Because there is, I mean, in so much as people are weary of bureaucracy, I think the success of the group proves that the value in umbrella organizations, that, you know, there are a lot of different groups and organizations across the city doing great things, but unless you have someone marshalling the efforts, it's kind of all happening in a vacuum. Or even in some case, overlapping their efforts. And there's
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, we struggle with it. A lot of orgs do, and I'm sure big orgs do for sure. Like, how do we not be redundant? How do we not, you know, keep reinventing the wheel, or us all doing things in parallel but not connected? So it's, I think till those kind of dominoes start falling, it's hard to imagine what some of those things could look like further down the kind of road.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, could we get there? And then once you get there, it's like, what kind of explodes from that? It's kind of almost hard to gauge sometimes, at least my experience in work, when kind of parts click, that kind of, you know, the gestalt-y kind of idea of like the sum of those parts is greater than the parts, right? You just sometimes can't imagine what interesting, cool, challenging things might come out of that. So I think, to give everyone credit who created that initial agreement, it's pretty hard to imagine where that could go.
And that's where the limits of bureaucracy are too, because bureaucracy very much depends on a certain quality of homeostasis or I guess reasonable expectation of what challenges are coming. When something big hits, like a natural disaster or a year where there's too much snowfall, it sends everything off track. But, you know, you kind of depend and even thrive on, you know, the unexpected solutions that present themselves.
Yeah, and what we all know, and your awesome examples, were we're grateful for those systems, right? When things happen and we need results and immediate things happen. And I guess what with the neighborhood groups, which are obviously at the heart of this, they're in our name and the work, is their ability on the ground to respond is a much more rapid and interesting, you know, it's just the freedom to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in larger organizations, there's a lot more parts to connect to do something, and also a different level of risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city doing something versus a neighborhood group carries a much different scrutiny, weight, risk that I think it's hard to do it.
Yeah, and the one, and maybe it's just the implication of the name, but the one, it feels like it's grassroots up, the other one feels like it's top down, and
people
absolutely can take more of an ownership when it's coming from the neighborhood level.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, there's a different, authenticity. I don't always know. There's so many interesting words to use, but that community-based solutions are pretty powerful things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often hard to kind of incorporate that in when you're in a larger system.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to, again, that authentic feedback. I think Councillor Gordon that night said, you know, sometimes we have outreach events and we get a handful of people or a couple of people and there's 100 people come to watch this delegation. Mm-hmm. So there's something beautiful about the coalition, the way it's been kind of gelling and forming, is that people are kind of, that night, besides whatever else comes out of it, what I heard in that room was there's a pride and an expanded sense of self. And like people walked away going, wow, I knew some, but it's such an interesting organization. People walked away feeling like, oh, we're part of something really cool. And I even had some folks say they'd never been in City Hall or certainly never in the council chambers, right? So it's, again, democratizing things a little, I think. And I learn a lot from the community and I continue to learn. And one of those was offering childminding or activities or away from different communities to attend with a little more comfort and ease or safety. And that we were able to set up a kind of kid station in the hall and made it feel a little less super formal. So people felt they knew their kids could come in. And like it just, and we've tried to adopt that at all our events or workshops that, you know, this isn't a place for just Adam and Brendan. If your kids or your mom or dad, like whoever wants to, how do we make it where you feel okay coming? Basically, a really easy sentence, but I think we overlook it sometimes and we don't do it well and be included.
And the kids' table was something really neat because I think that there is an air of formality when you go into City Hall and to introduce something that's fairly informal, like a kids' activities area. It did strike me, and maybe you can elaborate on this a bit, is I don't remember the last time I've seen a lobbying effort like that. I mean, there are occasions where, you know, where you get the water issue that comes up and Nestle has its workers come and sit in the gallery or, you know, it's the solid waste workers concerned about their jobs, so they come and pack the gallery.
Right.
It's been known to happen, but on behalf of a particular organization,
right,
I can't remember the last time I saw a lobbying effort like that.
That's cool. That's nice to hear. You probably have a way bigger kind of depth of knowledge in that area, but... Yeah, I was kind of curious, right? You never know if people are going to show or not, but it's interesting. People, you know, I'd send out a few reminders. We had neighborhood group leaders reminding each other. Mm-hmm. Like, it was kind of neat how you see the actual network activate. Mm-hmm. And you start to see, you know, the usual Facebook, Twitter, social media, and then our partners or even our, you know, we have official partners in the coalition, and then there's others we work with. So Pin, the old volunteer center, had made their own notice of my email and done their own graphic, and you just start to see how, you know, again, I'd send out this kind of very succinct email to whoever I could, and then how that again fractures off and becomes different ways of, hey, our friends are doing this, and hey, you know, we love the work we do together, or let's Hope House everyone. People had sent letters if they couldn't. I think just the nature of our work together, and we've all become, now it sounds kind of cliche, kind of more friends and connected, like we enjoy each other's company. Mm-hmm. People kind of even like the opportunity to hang out. Mm. And even if we're milling the hall, people were chatting it up, and it wasn't, I guess it wasn't duty bound, right? And you're not there because you're in the union or in that, and not to discount the power of that, but people were coming because they care and they've got to know each other, and it's like, let's do this. Mm-hmm. One, to support the initiative, but also like, hey, we all, this would be cool if we all get together and do this thing.
The other part of it is the incubator of democracy you mentioned. And, and maybe we can get into this a little bit, but, you know, there were people who got up and spoke who don't typically get up and speak at these kinds of events. For there was the one woman, and I was like, I can't remember her name, but she said she had social anxiety and she was overcoming it, delegating to city council, which is, you know, stressful enough for people like Keithio, who's there every other
meeting.
So it makes me wonder if this is also maybe a grassroots political organization, not in the sense that you're actively politicizing,
no,
but in the sense that you're creating leaders.
Yeah, and I guess politics is a broad word and we all use it differently, but and I guess sometimes we use kind of the idea of amplifying or focusing voice. Like, that's it. These are the people in the communities who know what, like, they're powerful people. And I get to work with Kim, and she works on programs, and we're working on other things. And she ends up sitting at tables, maybe in a more formal setting or a different, she wouldn't be invited or wouldn't feel welcome. Mm-hmm. But she's got incredible ideas and energy, and I guess what I see from people is that, you know, society sometimes doesn't acknowledge a lot of people or a lot of the gifts they have, and they judge or stereotype them, and I've been guilty in my own past of doing it. But people just, it's not like any of us can grant permission, but it's almost like given the permission to get engaged and to hear that what you have to say matters. It's, man, like Kim was someone who reached out, said she wanted to talk. Like I'd kind of sent out, is there anyone interested? Because for me, always, there's power in this. I'm a white guy. I run an organization that funds things. Like, if I say, hey, Adam, could you talk? What do you say to that? No? And then you fear, like, oh, does that compromise? As much as I want to deconstruct it, it's there.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to have some people say, I really want to talk. And I was like, are you sure? And she's like, yeah, I want to because of, you know, and Alicia was another one who kind of said, I said, are you sure? Because I don't want this to be coercive, or, and she's like, yeah, I'm pretty proud of the work and the journey I've been on, and I want to share it. So I think, man, like, again, like you said, it's weird for me to get in front of council, and it's kind of part of what I should do as my job, and but for those people, it's not a common occurrence for them to speak in front of an audience. And I mean, even that, the way the room's set up is like a giant pit, and you know, the mayor is about 40 feet away. Kind of like a, I know no one in that room wants that to feel that way, but it feels like everyone's focused around on you in a very kind of, I'm looking down. And it's an intimidating space for a lot of people. So that community members feel comfortable. And as you saw, the staff member in the Brand neighborhood just stood with her, right? That was part of like, can you come with me? I think I can do it, but... And the beauty is those two have built that relationship over years, and Lynn in that community has built so many trusted relationships that... She wants to do it and knows I have Lynn, and if there's a, if I need that strength, it's there. And it's super moving. Like, I see it a lot, and it's always, wow.
Yeah.
Like, those are the people. Wow.
And to get back to what you're saying about, you know, the people feeling like they are not, they don't have the tools, as it were, to take on leadership roles or to take on a political role. That, too, is also its kind of own social anxiety, that we have a certain image of what a politician is, even though we live in a time when, you know, certain people can become president of the United States. And
sure.
It's, I do wonder what it might take to overcome, and that that idea that I can't be a leader because I don't have, you know, debate experience or this or that, or I don't come from this particular background. And
I'm not rich, or I don't have kind of experience in rooms. And, and even the rules of play. Like, I know they're there, but, you know, when you're first there and it's through the mayor to the, you know, like there's like Robert's rules. There's so many rooms I go in and I realize, you know, I know why systems are in place, but sometimes I think they're put in there to obstruct engagement. Like if you go in and there's a consent agenda and you're playing by Robert's rules and you bring people in that's not their common discourse. Even if they go in the room, it's hard to engage. I remember the first time I went in a room like that, and I thought, I don't know what language people are speaking. I'm not sure where I'm allowed to be in or out. And yeah, I've learned so much from people saying, well, why don't you just say what it is you mean instead of obstructing it with professional or tech language. You know, I've learned a lot.
The techno-babble of government.
Yeah. Even when I was first visiting some of the neighborhood groups, I was talking about governance, and then someone said, why do you keep using that word?
Yeah.
What do you really mean? I said, well, leadership. And they're like, well, say leadership. I was like, okay, thanks. But I was raised with that word in my professional life, and I thought, oh, that's the word I should use.
Yeah.
To sound professional. I'm like, well, that's just silly. So,
yeah,
able to deconstruct some of that with each other, and as trust gets built, to be able to be called out as well, like saying, why are you talking that way, or why are we doing it that way? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think there's a need for people to act as translators, and I think that is partially my responsibility as a member of the media, and and I think that's maybe something you're trying to do too, because you're negotiating between these neighborhood groups where it is that, you know, around a table like this where you can, you know, reach out and touch someone on the arm versus, you know, you can't tap the mayor on the shoulder when you're standing at the delegation spot.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess that's, I mean, eventually you'd like it so deconstructed that the community can talk to Adam or the mayor
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's the kind of beautiful scenario, which is happening a little bit, but at least me in a room, why it's me, is always interesting. But where sometimes when I'm working with partners, even when there's the most well-meaning, intentioned moments, I can still see how the lens of their org and the framework of their mission is still, there's an imposition in that dialogue, right? Where they're I still like, well, you're still not asking, or you're still not fully hearing as much as you know. It's like, here's some stuff for you.
Yeah.
Instead of like, would this, what do you need? How would you want to see it happen? And it's happening, but you know, that's still where I can, because I'm in that kind of in between position where I can say, hey, that was super good, Adam, but I think you're still not listening or asking. You're kind of saying, here's the stuff and here's how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, well, I don't really ask for it and I don't know how to use it and I don't think I want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But a lot of those times in those power transactions, I find that to say no or to speak up, does that result in you never getting anything? You know, it's not that they've acted that way, but there's always that power of like, well, what do I say to Adam? He brings me a gift that I didn't ask for, do I?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do I react to that?
Right.
So it's often, but I think as we kind of keep trying to peel those layers off, now Adam's not just the guy from Family and Children's Services. Adam is the guy they've met 7 times.
Right.
So they can call Adam. You know, there's been times in the neighborhood groups where there's a situation or a family, something, someone needs support, and the people in the neighborhoods will call. I know Aaron Harvey was up that night as a perfect example. They'll call Aaron and say, this is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to imagine another community or another situation where someone calls Family and Children's Services to kind of collaborate, right? They're probably thinking, the minute I call, the switch gets flipped,
right?
And we're into abduction or crisis intervention. Is there a way we could not go to that? You know, we've had a few examples where families have been able to stay in the community and that these organizations have supported in slightly different ways, and even helping resource the neighborhood group in some ways to help do that.
Well, the same could be said about the police or even the public health unit.
Absolutely. And all of those folks, right? Yeah. We've had very discrete examples, and even where a couple of them are connecting in that community to do it. Because I guess the whole model is, how do we keep families in their community? You know, the minute that is disrupted, it's never the best option, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like extreme cases, but in general, taking kids out of their community or splitting families up isn't.
Right.
And it's really cool because the leadership in Guelph of those organizations get that philosophy. And that's pretty, like Rochelle who spoke, there's lots, but Rochelle and Jennifer and Aaron and Arif who spoke, they're all on committees and panels with me, and they get it. And it's not, I don't know, it's stripping away ego.
Mm-hmm.
Like they'll have those challenging and they're interested in that paradigm shift, and it's spectacular. Like for me to watch it as a layperson in some sense, I'm not a PhD, I'm not a master's of social work, thinking they're listening. Wow. And I think the community, the other layer back for me is, wow, they're listening.
Right.
Like really listening.
And it also strips down the walls, and in so much as those walls were imagined too, because, you know, we're talking about people who need and want to deal with other people. And I think there's the classical image of, you know, some bureaucrat just saying, well, these are the rules, and, you know, you have to do A, B, and C in response to D, E, F, and that's, you know, the long and the short of it.
Yeah, and we've had, you know, we've definitely had some of those moments, and again, where the neighborhood group, you know, it's, I don't always want them to have to go through me like I'm a conduit for it, but sometimes it's like, hey, our permit just got canceled, or public health called.
Mm.
I don't really understand what the heck's going on in our events in 3 days. And if you are the person at public health who did that, I can have a conversation, but I certainly know other layers in that organization to say, here's what's happening. I'm not sure why that. Is there an accommodation we can make where sometimes the community, it's just like, they shut us down and I don't know which door to knock on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping that we can all learn the right door, but in the meantime, I've been lucky enough to make enough connections to say, I was like, really? We're not going to do that, are we? What can we do as an org? And it may be, can you get an extension of your insurance? Or it's kind of like, okay, if you're the buffer and you're going to take the risk or you will do these steps, then we'll let it happen. So it's been really interesting. And then we've seen kind of, well, is there a way we can change that process in the future? Because we've bumped up against this a couple times now, and I don't think you like it, and I don't think the community likes it. So,
right.
But, you know, people, there's so much strata in larger orgs that these people have their jobs to do, and they have to follow the rules the way they're told, or that they understand them. And I get it, right? You've got a gig.
Yeah.
And if someone wears a red shirt and you said, you're not allowed a red shirt, they have to say, you can't come in.
Right.
Even if it seems, when you deconstruct, it seems pretty ridiculous. So I think we've been seeing some shifts in maybe how organizations do their work, because now they're hearing, yeah, that is a bit odd. Why do we do it that way?
Mm-hmm.
And we've had our organization change, and others where, you know, there's another old name, but they had a certain rule about kind of attendance to a program, and it just had been around for a long time. And then someone in the neighborhood said, well, that's a really weird rule. Why would, and they're like, huh, you know, we never actually went and revisited it, and they changed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they even made it better than a lot of ours. And it just, yeah, it's listening, right? And starting to think, they don't hate me as a person. They just wonder why the heck, what the rule's for. And if you can explain it, then I get it. But if you can't, then why do we do it?
And it's, and that change only comes when people ask why. Because people will follow a rule or a law. And, you know, we see that at all levels of government, that there are laws on the books that are, you know, days gone by, you know, this might have made sense, but
yeah,
it doesn't make sense in 2017, 2018 anymore, so why are we still following it? And the reason everybody still follows it is because it's always been followed.
Yeah, and we're all, I mean, we're probably in your own life, and
sure,
things to do, right? We all just like, yeah, or someone finally says, why do you always do that? You're like, good question. I have no idea why I always do that, but I do it.
That's right.
Yeah, but I guess the beauty is that the ability to question is a powerful one, and I don't think people, especially when they're experiencing whatever it is, poverty, you know, racism, or the intersection of those, is, so the minute I question this, does it mean I stop being able to access anything? So if I question Ontario Works or ODSP or the way the City Fair program works, is there a punitive side to this, right? Where, you know, I don't think rich, upper middle class rich people worry about repercussions of challenging things. So I think their voice is built in, or the voice of privilege just assumes I can go and question something. But
right,
when you've continually been someone who's marginalized or oppressed, challenging the system has rarely turned out in your favor.
Yeah, the more privileged you are, the more of a buffer you have, the more of a cushion, I guess, if in case you do slip and fall, you land comfortably, and, you know, the less cushioning you have, the more uncomfortable the fall. And
yeah, and even so, or very little resistance sometimes, right?
Yeah.
You and your other privileged friends and neighbors have the ability to rally, and the ability to navigate systems, because they work in those systems. You know, it's...
Right.
There's those layers of it, right? And I guess in this, what we're hoping is deconstruct that, or kind of share with each other, well, that's a cool skill set. How do we learn? You know, we see a lot of that between the different groups, where they may come from more affluent economically, or in other communities more affluent in kind of community development and spirit. Like, how do those... Because we talk about vulnerable and priority communities a lot, and it feels kind of gross. It feels like we're... Adam comes from a vulnerable community.
Right.
Well, it's an underserved, a neglected community by our society, but it's certainly not...
It's almost
so
predatory,
many,
too.
It's that's a great word. Yeah, it's claiming, well, those people.
Right.
Right? And you're like, wow, when you're in that community, there's so many incredible strengths and resiliency and how people connect to support each other, where, you know, I know a lot of friends in neighborhoods where they don't know their neighbors, they would never go to each other for support.
Right.
The kind of closed communities, right? A lot of the developments you see, the garage is the first thing you see, and people pull in and are never up front. And, you know, some of these so-called vulnerable priority communities, there's so much incredible power and work that gets done there, and so much volunteerism, and it's pretty inspiring. So I hate that kind of dichotomy between the have-not mentality.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's true. They have a lot more money and resources. Let's balance that.
And you could say those communities are vulnerable in other ways, because,
yeah,
you know, if you don't know your neighbors, if you're never, you know, seen out front, you know, who's to say, you know, someone who shouldn't be out front is I don't know if that's the owner, or if that's the person who lives there or not. It's I guess it's very contextual that way.
You nailed it. I remember I was at a work conference There's a guy named Jim Deers. He's a guy from Seattle. He had kind of worked on the neighborhood framework there. And I'm not going to get the story exactly right, but basically he said there was some crime or some things that happened in the neighborhood, and the police and kind of community response to the community was, we're going to supply deadbolts and teach people how to install them and whatever. And he said, you know, in my opinion and the community's opinion was the exact opposite. Let's open our doors. Let's get on the street. Let's connect more. Because like you said, the minute you shut your door, I don't know whose neighbor that is, and I don't know whose kid that is, and I don't know if Adam lives here. I don't, you know. And of course, there's other safety issues, but I just, that stuck with me of like, the first reaction is insular. Like, let's hide, let's protect what we have. And his is, let's get to know each other.
Right.
And protect and love each other. And I was like, wow, what a neat, you know, those moments that stick in your head. You're like, well, that's cool, right? Because it, the initial is like, open your door seems the wrong thought. We've been trained. Something bad's happening. Open your door. It's like, that seems weird.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's what we, what we're learning in this work is when you're more connected, that makes your community more powerful.
Well, we've covered a lot of the theoretical ground.
Sorry,
But I
get super excited about the work, so.
But I do want to get into the practical work, too, because the ask is for an extra $100,000, and you said that's not growth. That is merely kind of keeping things where they are right now. As we said at the top, the limits of that initial grant have been reached in a way much sooner than anticipated.
Yeah.
So let me phrase it this way. What does the group stand to lose if without that $100,000, whether that's something specific or something that, you know, maybe lost opportunities to continue that growth?
Well, for sure lost opportunities. And I guess a really cool part I've noticed is I get really interesting emails and calls, and the more connections we make, the more interested other people will be, come and say, hey, I've heard about this neat project, or I've heard about that, and I've got a really interesting idea. We have resources we want to bring in, whether it's the road. Like, people just come now and thinking, oh, well, this is a collaborative space. And collaboration plus action, we've seen it. Could we do something together? So I think that kind of gets to a point where these are all super exciting ideas, and it could be as small as a group of powerful people in town want to start a girls' rock camp, and they were looking for space. You know, we collaborated, and now it's in its third year, and they're trying to expand it. And it's a really cool program up to the SEED, which is a food security thing. It kind of come out of discussions through the Poverty Task Force and the GNSC and the Health Center were kind of leads to kind of initiate that. And now there's a, you know, a citywide cooler and storage site to collect the food, and now Chalmers and Wyndham House and the Health Center and the neighborhood groups are all using this cooler and using the distribution network. So super powerful things have come out of it. And I, you know, that's the fear, that as that grows, there's only so many yeses to those conversations, right? It's just, we don't have time. And I guess the other is with the expansion of, you know, activities and participants, there's a point where it's just, how do we maintain that? You know, we have those summer camps and we don't really have a summer camp person to help run and coordinate it. And I don't know if you know Dan Evans, you've probably met Dan or know him.
Yeah.
You know, he's the neighborhood support worker. He works with the core staff and he's got all these other duties. And then last summer he was the summer coordinator. And, you know, it's those where it's, and, you know, his job isn't technically covered under the current agreement. We're grant scrambling and doing stuff. And FNCS had one-time money for the first year. And, you know, I think it's just, it's hard to, and I guess when you're in the city, maybe some of the things that, the powerful things they have in the city, it's hard to put a value on it. You know, like, they have a payroll department. They have a, you know, all those things that are absorbed through being part of that organization. I'm not sure, you know, I wasn't in the room, so I don't know, but it's hard to, you know, hey, there's a new org, but now it's like, oh, we have 20 to 60 staff, so we have payroll, and then we have we have to have an account, and then we need a, you know, a policy on this, and WSIB, and like all the things that were kind of there, maybe existed in a way that isn't obvious. You know, we know we're paying programs, we know we're doing it supporting this way, but all the kind of infrastructure of a really cool giant organization has. Mm-hmm. It's like, we have a legal department, we don't have to hire a lawyer. Like,
right.
They're here, Adam's here, we'll just go talk to Adam. Yeah. So I think a lot of that just, you know, gets absorbed by the org and should, but as I said that night, you know, Dan and I were the HR department, the finance department, the legal department, the policies and procedures department, and then we're the grant department and the fundraising department. And, you know, with the kind of level of activity of the neighborhood groups and the coalition, it's just, yeah, we just literally don't have the time to connect and be there really hands-on in the programs and then supporting those communities while we're running the org. And so it's a really interesting balance. So kind of capped out. And as the interest grew, we had, you know, 3 new neighborhood groups, 2 partners. We have others asking. It's all, we don't have the funds to say, come join Adam, here's some seed money.
Right.
But it's also like, well, what do we do with 2 more groups? Like, how do we really embrace it and help and be there for them when we're kind of stretched out a bit? It's just, you know, I don't want to say, join Adam, and then say, I don't really have any time to encourage, you know, connect you in the ways that I think would be powerful.
Right.
Not that, you know, the neighborhood groups run themselves and they're super powerful, but startup groups, or sometimes there's an evolution in the group where there's been a really high point in leadership and volunteer, you know, there's life cycles to things. And in those times, I think our value is, how do we help kind of weather those moments in time? So it's a bunch of factors. Minimum wage, we knew, was going up. It hadn't been declared till I think it was today or yesterday. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And even that, the impact of that's probably anywhere between 12 and 20,000, you know, when we hire summer students. So just the, you know, there's so many factors in that 100,000, it sounds ungrateful, but if you get it, it's kind of like, woo, at least we can kind of stay where we are and continue the work we're doing without kind of thinking, how could it really explode?
Well, I mean, it's not even half a percentage of the total city budget too. And I think when you show up with a gallery full of people, it sends a pretty good message to the council that this is important too. So putting that aside though, the immediacy of the 100,000.
Yeah.
But I imagine you have plans beyond, you know, what people come to you with. I did note the conversation. I can't remember if it was you that Carl Wettstein was asking about, you know, doesn't the province take some share of this as well? But that almost seems like passing the buck in a different way. Leaving that aside, though, I wonder, and I have been wondering the last couple of days since that meeting, is there anything that the neighborhood group can't do?
I haven't seen it, but I guess... yeah, maybe medical triage, but you know, we're also the groups, because they're there. I mean, they've, the staff and the volunteers in the community are going to opioid workshops and gotten naloxone kits. Like, there is a, man, when I've spent time in some of them, or even when I've been there, the kind of moments of beauty and crisis that come in, people come in with lots of trauma. I don't think so. You know, the big formal things, like, again, hospitals, you know, outside of that, I don't think so. I think neighborhood groups have this incredible, and it's like anyone, right? If I came to your house and said, I think I know how to set your house up differently, or you have a problem with your family, and let me tell you how to, you know, most of the people in the community have lived there a while and have, if not answers, really good questions and ideas. And I think a lot of the time, solutions are imposed, or at least not collaborated on, and people feel devalued or angry, right? Like, why didn't... We're the ones who, once you go away, we're the ones who live with whatever happens.
Right.
And again, I think there's been a very powerful part of our population who are very comfortable with those discussions and combating ideas or being kind of vocal and fighting, and others who have felt less... ability. Like, I think a lot of people would be like, well, what is the point of me going to City Hall or the police office or public health, right? It's a giant building. I'm going to walk in and say, I want to talk to someone. And I didn't know. Yeah, great, Adam. Here's the form. There's the clerk, right?
Right.
Like there's no, it would be pretty frustrating as an individual to do that, but B, I think some of the reaction has been that, right? Like, okay, well, here's a form, or if you go online, or... Yeah, and people just feel... I mean, I'm sure you have in your life. I've navigated systems, and I feel like I've been given a fair bit of privilege, and systems, I've been in systems, and I get kind of lost and caught off guard and frustrated and feel dumb, and I can't imagine, you know, given what I've been given in my life, I can't imagine what it's like. Like, I maybe can get past the first hurdle because of I've got a supportive partner or, you know, whatever it is, but when you're on your own or you've had so many chances when people have dismissed you, of course you're not going to keep coming or you're not going to ask it. So, yeah, if I think now through the coalition, that kind of bringing that voice, centering that voice a bit is the power of it. But if, you know, as that's happening, that the community can help each other, it's pretty cool. And I've seen it, you know, if you look at Two Rivers, their newsletter, you know, there's a Garden Fresh Box and a cooking night and a baby infant massage and discussion circle and a coffee hour and a mental health check and like there's just, if you looked at it, it would look like a city guide, right? You're thinking, oh my gosh, we have one staff there and that parent outreach worker Marianne who was there and a little bit of paid here and there, but really it's community let them run. And they just, once people feel super connected and secure and feeling safe, you know, that story Marianne told about Amanda and even Alicia, where she was, you know, a mom receiving support and wasn't working and didn't feel empowered. And man, if you followed her around in your days now, she was always this amazing person, but for whatever the way our society had been, she didn't feel empowered. But man, she kicks ass. She's the kind of person that she's been teaching yoga in prison for women's. Like, she's just kind of like, she does incredible things outside of the neighborhood too, but she's just, and you just, those stories are, I mean, not everyone's Alicia, but those stories, just there's so many of them, and the more we all work together, it's pretty amazing watching people, and again, like Kim, stand up in front of a crowd where you're thinking, wow, that's the, if you have social anxiety and other issues, you think, hey, how about you come to city council and chat? It's probably not your on your checklist of like fun things to do, but
no.
So neighborhood groups have that really cool ability to respond and react, and I don't think that got fully told in front of council. There's so much to tell, but that's part of the cool things, right? Like, let's try something. Let's work on a solution you think might work, and how can we support that? Sometimes it fails, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it needs tweaking, but the beauty is failure's kind of part of it, or mistakes. And I think that's the other cool thing in the neighborhoods. It's not like, well, Adam, you said this, this, and this were going to happen, but only this and this happened.
Right.
We're going to cancel that program.
Yeah.
Or you even said to people, you know, it's volunteer-driven. We have free space. If you set up a coffee hour and two people show up for the first couple of weeks, it's okay. They're the two who needed it. But what, you know, what do you want from it? And it's not always the hard evaluation, right? If we don't have 6.5 people coming for and drink three coffees a week, then we failed. It's, you know, or we've even seen that where a couple of people come and weeks later, like eight are in the room because those two people were the first, the early adopters. Like, is this safe? Can I be here? And they're like, hey, come with me, man. That's really cool. So I think the neighborhoods have that real cool ability to kind of roll with things and adapt and create. So it's pretty amazing.
But that just draws the vivid picture that, you know, you and Dan deal with trying to hold on to this, what you've created. And you need sort of the wiggle room in order to grow it further, because the day may come when somebody might need that window, that opportunity to create the next Alicia and the next Kim, and maybe that opportunity isn't there because you're busy trying to find money to keep what's going on right now.
And I guess we're all co-creating, so there's nothing, I don't feel like I create anything, but I mean, that's it. And then there's sometimes in neighborhoods where challenges erupt and people are you know, with some of the drug things that have happened, or even meth or different things, that there's a community concern, and all of us kind of move over to a neighborhood for a while and try to rally the partners and listen to the community about good and bad. Like, what do we need to, what do you need, and how can we support it? And that's some of the powerful stuff. And when your properly energy is diverted there too. Like you wanted, this is her job.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're back going, well, I haven't run that annual fundraiser. And, you know, it's right. Just, so it's, yeah, you're right. It's drawing on a, I never wanted to sound like, oh, poor guy, he's got so much to do. But
right.
It's, you know, there's a, there's mission stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess there's stuff like any human or any business, there's stuff to keep the business running.
Right.
Like all the stuff you need, the insurance and the stuff and the grants and the reporting. And then there's your mission driven, right? And it's, there's a time you have to allot for the, keep the car running.
Right.
And then what are we doing once we get in the car? So it's challenging when there's two people and one isn't fully really covered. So it's.
Right. But I think that plays into, we don't, when we're asking, and this goes doesn't just go for you, but you know, for, I think any at all charities, you don't celebrate, you don't go to a council and say, we're having this incredible success and we need more money in order to help facilitate our success.
Yeah.
It's be like, I am so overworked and my other staff member is overworked.
Yeah,
and
we
kind of need the assistance to, you know, to make sure the good work continues, otherwise it might go away.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I wanted to end and I hope it came across, but I mean, this thing that happened, the city in their cool vision realized it needed to not be in the city and there was probably a better way and did this work with the community. And I'm like, well, it worked. You know, and I read the kind of founding things when I started, but I haven't read them in 4 or 5 years. And going back prior to this, I was like, hey, maybe not. Yeah. But I was like, hey, the kind of things you'd hoped happened. And then even, so I don't want to digress too much, but it had been set up like we should have a neighborhood panel and a partner panel where reps from all the neighborhoods group get together and, you know, become this powerful force for this, and then all the partners get together and do this. And that framework's really good, but even at the neighborhood panel we realized, I did some surveys and we did some Skype, it felt again very like, let's do it this way, and then everyone's like, that's kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
Could we change it? So even the way those models were set up are working at some level, but they were, again, it was early and like, maybe this could happen. It's like, it did, but people didn't want it to be super prescriptive. Or, and what happened was these two panels said, well, we're not really hanging out with each other. Like both kind of said it to me, and I'm in both rooms. So we had a kind of speed dating hangout thing at the Common. We bought coffees for everyone and someone had catered it. Public Health bought some food. And people just started hanging out at tables, talking. We had some exercises. And then out of that, everyone's like, we should do that a couple times a year. So just again, the organizations, the partner organizations were like, it's so cool to hear from people. And no one's wearing their uniforms or their lab coats. It's not like, ooh, everyone's like, they learn so much and very in the minute concrete things like, well, how do I do this? And someone's like, well, I'll get an answer. So people said, hey, well, we should do that more. And then we thought, okay, well, maybe we plan a fall meeting where we take some of the things that really bubbled up and we have a meeting where we're like, let's figure out some cool actions on these. So it's just, again, how they, the model was set up and it's super cool. But then again, what's bubbled up from that is, man, it could be even cooler if we did another different thing together. So yeah, I think the city, I think it, and it's really hard, right? Council, it's even like a board of directors. It's hard for them often to really know what's happening on the ground. And of course, city councilors aren't going to understand the complexity, but I think that night at least let them see like, hey man, this thing we wanted to happen and invested in, if nothing else, it's happening and it's pretty cool, and obviously people care.
Yeah.
If nothing else, right? Like a lot of people feel this is an important thing, professionals and the community.
It's pretty cool. So hard to translate that kind of informality of it.
Yeah.
You're going back to council and saying, you know, they're used to the formal structure of the agendas and minutes and bylaws.
Yeah.
And the success of the coalition seems to be in the informal, and that's
right.
That's and hard the, to take that bridge back.
Of those. Yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Cool things happening. Like, oh, great. That's my return on investment for cool things. You know, and I guess that's why we were very intentional about who was speaking and when, so we could try and somehow paint a larger canvas, so it's like, oh, because I think at first you hear 8 summer camps and lots of programs,
right?
And you think it's all rec and it's all valuable, but okay, great, so what, that's awesome, we give you money, great. Mm-hmm. It's like the other, what we've been talking about when you hear a castle, like it's more than that, but it's not, you know, I made the joke that's not saving puppies. It's not a very easy sentence to say, when you give us money, we get people off drugs and they get a job, you know, although that happens, but we don't have that one straight line narrative that's very simple to say. Our mission is to get a vegetable in every kid's hand, and every kid got a vegetable last year. It's part of all of it, and it's about social cohesion and resiliency and connectedness, and you know, it's, there's no metrics for those sometimes.
Yeah, they want to see this the statistics, but this is, the statistics aren't the story.
Right, and we have good stats, but to me it's like they're kind of 2D, or they're, for me it's great. Like seeing is like, when even when I see it collected, I'm like, wow. But I'm thinking, the wow is even behind those numbers, right? It's, the wow is the Alicias and the Kims and the stories and the, what you see all the time. And I see it over and over. Mm-hmm. And like, that's, for me, they're in those numbers, but it's, you don't see it. Mm-hmm. You can't see it. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So how do we get that across? How do we tell those stories with power? So that was the cool part, I think, for a lot of us in that room to hear it resonating.
Well, I don't know if this interview went the way I figured, but I mean, maybe that's in keeping with the conversation.
It's kind of how a strange people in the coalition roll.
I guess so. But Brendan, thank you so much for what you do and for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Adam. I'm a fan and it's been a long time coming.
And once again, that was Brendan Johnson, Executive Director of the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition. And you can learn more about the coalition on their website at GuelphNeighborhoods.org, and to find out whether or not they get their extra funding, you will have to follow along on Budget Decision Night, which actually starts at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, December 5th. And that's all for the Guelph Politicast this week. The music from the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, and Sid Dale, the host for the Guelph Politicast, is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can donate to the Guelph Politico Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.